Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
The Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is James W. Russell. Jim is professor of sociology at Eastern Connecticut State University. He's the author of 6 books, many articles. He was the first editor of New Left Notes. It's a national newspaper of students for a democratic society. Do we ever need one now? And Jim, last July, wrote an important article that he was kind enough to send to me. It is very, very timely for what we can talk about this morning. He called it Retirement Crisis in the United States. Now, given what's going on since Obama came out with his tax-cutting proposal, and in that proposal, it's not being explained right. Well, none of it is explained right when you get media reports, major media reports. But in my opinion, and others, in an article that I'll get out tomorrow, I've already put out 5 articles on what Obama is doing or trying to do and the Democrats are trying to do. And the one I put out today, I hope they prove me wrong, because I'd love to have egg on my face over this. The article I put out today, I titled, "The Fix is In. Expect Democrats to Buckle." So we had all the bluster last week. Bernie Sanders, for example, on the Senate floor for 8 hours on Friday, bluster, meaningless. I sent him 4 emails. I sent him this article. I challenged him, very politely, to basically put his vote where his rhetoric is. And he didn't call his 8 hours on Friday a filibuster. Well, he said you can call it that, but he really called it a long speech, which is exactly what it was, because it meant nothing. Filibusters happen on the day a vote is supposed to take place. And the idea of a filibuster is to kill it, to keep the filibuster going until the vote doesn't happen and the proposal is killed. Oftentimes, it's to kill something good. Well, a filibuster Monday would be to kill something very, very destructive. In Obama's proposal, it has a 2%, he calls it a temporary 2-year payroll tax reduction. Well, it's not temporary, and the idea behind it isn't to stimulate, create jobs and stimulate economic growth. And any legitimate economist will explain that. And next week I'll have one on who will explain it. He's got a brand new article he sent me overnight. And I've got it. I haven't read it yet, but I will. And he makes the point very strong, very strongly, that the tax cuts and the rest of Obama's plan will do absolutely nothing to create jobs. Well, the 2% reduction in payroll tax, in my opinion, is a stealth plan to drive a dagger into the heart of Social Security. Well, Jim wrote about Social Security in his article. And he inspired me to do one. I called it a class warfare jeopardizing American workers' security. Let me just quote Jim, and I put a few of my own words in just to smooth out his quote, just to make it all run together. But in his article, again called Retirement Crisis in the United States, he said, quote, "The great 30-year experiment in 401k and similar retirement financing schemes that depend on stock market investments has failed. Even before the, couple of my words, even before the 2008 crash, it was clear, the signs everywhere, that very few workers would be able to accumulate enough wealth through these accounts to insure their retirement futures. And, of course, this is so different from Social Security. It's a government contract mandated to deliver. Obama wants to cancel the contract. Jim, I usually have much shorter introductions because I've written so much of this and I keep going, and I still have another article coming out tomorrow. I just couldn't resist chiming into this. So discuss your article and all the related issues, which is so timely right now. Let me let you take over.
Well, thanks a lot, Steve, for having me on the program. I'm sort of like you in that I can talk forever on the subject. For a lot of people, retirement is an extremely complicated area, but once you clear away a few of the complications, it becomes very, very clear what's at stake. What's happened in the United States is that up until around 1981, if most people had Social Security, and then they also had a retirement plan through their work, which was a guaranteed pension. But then in 1981 is when the 401ks began to take off and replace the guaranteed pensions. And those were sold on two absolutely false arguments. The first argument was that if people had 401k accounts, they would do a lot better than if they were in traditional pensions. Well, that, you know, we're now, you know, almost 30 years down the road from there. And so we've had people who've retired under 401ks, and they've realized, uh-oh, this is nowhere near what I would have gotten. By our calculations, in a lot of cases, people are getting less than half what they would have gotten if they'd been in a traditional pension plan. The other argument that has turned out to be very false is that to finance 401ks, it takes less money than to finance traditional pensions. In fact, for the same amount of benefits, it costs much, much less to do it under a traditional pension plan. So we've had this transformation in retirement that has put a lot of people in a much more insecure position than they would have otherwise been. And then what you were talking about with Social Security, which is really kind of our great backstop in this country, which is a very, very successful program. It's very sound. It makes the difference between poverty and lack of poverty of something like some huge amount of people who are over 65. There's been, ever since around the late 1970s, a concerted campaign to privatize it. It's ebbed and flowed, the campaign. The plan A was to privatize. That's what Bush tried in 2005, ran against a huge wall of opposition from the public. And then plan B is to cut back the benefits. That's what the Deficit Commission was trying to peddle. And then when the Deficit Commission didn't get the votes that it needed to make it automatically be taken up by Congress, we found out about Plan C, which is Obama's tax holiday, basically, that is being proposed in the tax bill. So we have just this consistent effort, really, to undermine Social Security, despite it enjoying overwhelming public support.
Jim, can I read you a great quote from Franklin Roosevelt when he signed
Sure.
the law in 1935? He signed the Social Security Act. I mean, I just simply can't imagine Obama, anybody saying something like this, especially the punchline. And he said, quote, "We put those payroll contributions there so as to give the contributions a legal, moral, and political right to collect their pensions and their unemployment benefits. With those taxes in there, no damn politician can ever scrap my Social Security program." Well, I've got this in my article going out tomorrow, and my tagline after that is, FDR never met Obama or congressional Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
Even if he didn't mean it 100%, Jim, I mean, that was a powerful statement. You'd never hear a politician talking that way today, but he did.
No, you know, unfortunately, even people who are nominal supporters of Social Security in the Democratic Party don't seem to really understand it completely, just how important it is, which then sets them up to be willing to accept a little bitty 2% cut in the financing of it, you know, for just 2 years. Or 1 year? No, it's 1 year is what they're actually proposing now.
You know, I saw it both ways. I saw some reports saying it's 2 years, other reports saying 1 year, and then I found a quote by Obama. I hope it's right, where he said 2 years. Now, just because he said it, maybe they. I mean, they're going back and forth on this, Jim. So you know, one day it's this, the next day it's that. Well, it's ostensibly a temporary extension. But the key point is that once you give a tax cut, it's very hard to take it back. I mean, Republicans hate tax increases. An awful lot of Democrats also hate tax increases. And during hard times, oh, it is not a good idea to increase taxes. And during election years, which is half of them, it's not a good idea to increase taxes. So what is offered as something temporary often may turn out to be permanent. Well, maybe not permanent, but longer term. So the idea that this is going to be 1 or 2 years, I think, is completely bogus.
Well, I think even if we assume the best of intentions on the part of Obama, that he really does support it and Social Security and so forth, I mean, he's really playing with fire for all the reasons that you mentioned. This is the first time ever that there's been a tax holiday on Social Security contributions. And then, you know, of course, to then turn around a year or 2 years from now, whichever it is, and say to people, well, you know, sorry, but we're going to have to, you know, increase your taxes and your income is going to go down by 2%. I can just see all the right-wing sound machine and the Republicans. What? They're going to tax us more? And then somebody's going to say we should make this a permanent, you know. And because so many people don't really understand how Social Security is financed, it'll set up long-term problems. To me, it's very similar to what happens when you have public employee pension funds in states. And the states run into financial problems, and so they decide to just suspend their contribution to it. And then, you know, down the road, the fund is coming up a little short, and then they start saying, well, you see, these things don't work, so we really need to put everybody in a 401k instead. Well, of course, it's not, nothing is going to work if you don't properly fund it. And, you know, Social Security is a bargain, you know, at the cost and what it gives out. But if you don't put anything in, it's not going to work. Or if you cut it back, you're just going to squeeze it.
And, of course, they never say a word about the fact that this is not a welfare program, just like Medicare is not a welfare program. These are insurance programs, and we sign a as far as I'm concerned, we sign a contract with Washington that during our working lives, we will pay insurance premiums by payroll tax deductions, and then when we're eligible, for most people, it's when they retire. Also, disabled people get Social Security, and there are some other recipients of Medicare. Survivors get Social Security. There are death benefits also.
Right.
When you're eligible, the government has told you, I mean, you might as well have a written contract. The government has told you, you will get these benefits. Well, now they want to change them en route to, I believe, annulling them, Jim. And I think it'll come incrementally. You know, you get this proposed payroll tax holiday, and then, as you say, the system doesn't work. We need to go to a 401k idea, which is privatization, and that doesn't work. So, you know, the whole thing, what Franklin Roosevelt created in the 1930s, well, if he's at all aware, rolling in his grave, what's going on, he's just screaming to be able to come back and make a comment on this. I think they want to kill the plan altogether, and they'll do it in steps.
Well, this is what I think is happening, that if I can just indulge in a bit of history here, if you go back to when 401(k)s started in 1981. That's also the same year that in Chile they privatized their entire national retirement system under a military dictatorship. And that kind of sat out there for a while because it was done under such odious conditions. But then in the early 1990s, the World Bank basically endorsed what had happened in Chile and set up this model, which is what I think they're trying to do in Washington, where programs like Social Security would be reduced to only being small programs to take care of poverty, elderly poverty, and ultimately become means-tested welfare programs. And so, you know, that would cost less money than what Social Security costs now. It would not benefit, you know, people, working-class people, middle-class people, people who are primary beneficiaries right now. And then all of those people who are now enjoying good Social Security benefits would be forced to get 401k type plans. And so you would move a whole bunch of capital, which is now being tied up by governments and through the public sector, you would move that into Wall Street and the private market in general. So, you know, as I see all of these various proposals that are, being put forward in Washington, they almost seem like they're being scripted by the World Bank or at least people who are very close to that type of thinking. So I can just go one more example of that. In the Bowles-Simpson Commission, most people concentrated on them wanting to raise the retirement age from full retirement age from 67 to 69. Which indeed is very important. But I think far more important than that was that they were recommending a change in the benefit formula so that, and this was very disingenuous of them, what they were doing. They called it a progressive change. That is, people at higher incomes would have more severe cuts than the poorest of people. But if you look at that, what the effect of that would be to cut out what is now the middle class support for Social Security. And that's one of the reasons why it's been able to succeed over all the years. Because if you look at it, the people who make these decisions, as you have in the article I'm actually reading on the screen, you have a bunch of millionaires and others who will be making these decisions. They don't need Social Security for themselves. And so if, you know, so they just want to really move it, you know, into, you know, all of that money into the private market, which is where they have all of their investments. So a lot of this is really, I think, just very, very consistent with the attempt to reduce Social Security ultimately to a means-tested anti-poverty program and not a form of social insurance that most people would benefit from.
That would be another way to kill it, Jim. I agree with you. I absolutely believe that would kill it. Means testing is a terrible idea. And this, the idea that everybody gets the same benefit, you take it away from one, you take it away from everybody. But if it's means tested, this made it real easy on something that is means tested. Welfare for needy people, and it made it very easy in 1996 for Bill Clinton to end welfare, because
absolutely,
only the poor people needed welfare, not the rich, not the middle class. So you
right.
know they didn't give it a thought that welfare was being well. Yeah, I mean they might have thought about it, but it wasn't coming out of them. They weren't being hurt directly, so it was very easy to kill the program. And of course, they did it the way they did. It didn't end on a given day. They set it up so that it will last for so many years, and then you got to go to work and do things like this, regardless of the fact that you get single mothers and they're very poor and they get kids, and maybe they got to stay home and take care of their kids because who's going to take care of them if they don't? Well, you've got all these things thrown in, but who cared about it? It's very easy to end welfare, Jim, but it is not easy to end a benefit that everybody gets and everybody enjoys. They don't want to give it up. So right now, Jim, I mean, you would think, in one sense, We have an easier thing to kill. We have these tax cuts that I believe absolutely will be extended for everybody, including for the rich. But it seems like a no-brainer to end them for rich people who don't need the benefit. They've got so much now that if they pay a little more in taxes, all it means is they'll have a little less that they'll save, but they'll still have more than they'll ever need or ever be able to spend. And yet there's a furor over ending these cuts. And I believe beneath the bluster of Democrats, they don't want to end them any more than Republicans want to end them. And that's what I brought out in my article yesterday, Jim. I mean, Congress, especially the Senate. The Senate is a millionaires' club. Half or more of the Senate, no, two-thirds of the Senate are millionaires.
Yes.
Well, they benefit from these kinds of cuts. They don't want to give them up. Nancy Pelosi, who made some high-sounding statements, well, her net worth is estimated by Open Secrets, OpenSecrets.org. They estimate her wealth with her husband, who's very wealthy. How much comes from her, how much comes from him, I'm not sure. But they estimate her net worth at up to about $125 million.
Not worrying about her Social Security check.
Well, she doesn't need a Social Security check, but she doesn't want higher taxes. I mean, whatever she may want, Jim, you can bet your life her husband doesn't want higher taxes, and that might be cause for divorce if she lets that go through.
Well, actually, though, I mean, you do have, granted, it's a small minority of rich people who are farsighted enough to realize that this is absurd, this low rate of taxation that they have. It's the lowest rate in the Western world. So you do have a few, very few, but a few who are arguing that, you know, even from their point of view, this is not such a good idea to do this.
But there are two deficit-cutting commissions. Obama last January declared that there'll be a three-year freeze on discretionary federal spending beginning in 2011, just around the corner now. And austerity is the buzzword because of the federal deficit supposedly out of control, no mention of why it's out of control and what should be cut, not the awful stuff that should be cut. But both deficit-cutting commissions not only want to sock it to middle and lower-income people, they want to increase benefits for rich people. Well, they want to do it by cutting the tax rates. They call it simplifying it, Jim. You know, the code language, simplify the tax code. But one of the commissions wants to institute a national sales tax. Well, it's no secret who that hits hottest. It certainly doesn't hit the rich people hottest. It hits ordinary people, many of whom pay little or no taxes. So, I mean, these are awful proposals. They haven't been debated yet, but they will come up, and I fear what's going to happen along with the Social Security business.
Well, my daughter actually today called Obama the best Republican Democratic president we've had since Bill Clinton.
How old is your daughter?
She's a union organizer.
She's not a young kid.
No.
Oh, my goodness. Well, there's no question about that. There barely is any difference. Certainly there's no difference in core issues between Republicans and Democrats. And people thinking there is, they better wake up, Jim, and they ought to see something about what's going on right now and what Obama is proposing. Get past the smooth rhetoric and just look at what the policy is. Forget the bluster and just check out how these people will vote. You know how the Republicans will vote, but check out how the Democrats will vote. Check out how the best of them will vote. You can go online and see how they cast their votes for every piece of legislation. And even the so-called best of them in Congress, maybe somebody like Kucinich in the House and Bernie Sanders in the Senate, they cave so often that their credibility is gone to people who really see what they do when voting time comes around. And again, forget what they say. Just watch how they vote. And they vote Republican all too often on some terrible stuff. And I'm convinced they're going to do it. They're going to do it again enough to get this awful proposal passed. Some will get a pass because their votes aren't needed. But if their votes are needed, no pass, they'll go along with what Obama wants, I'm convinced. And I think it's the beginning of, dare I say it, the death knell of Social Security, Jim, as we know it now.
Well, I'm not quite that pessimistic in that if we look back at 2005, there was a very impressive coalition of labor and community groups and AARP that fought the privatization. And right now, that coalition has already sprung back to life. The question is whether, you know, they'll be able to do damage before there's time really to mobilize against it. But I don't think that it'll be an easy thing to kill Social Security. I think it'll be a sort of attempt to slowly strangle it behind people's backs. But I think there are a lot of people who are aware of that, and, you know, including, you know, the major labor unions, so forth. So I hope that there's going to be at least a good fight over it. It's not going to be just something that will be quietly done, or even something like welfare reform that, you know, just a couple of people quit their jobs and that was pretty much it. It was done. But I really don't believe it'll be the same with Social Security.
Well, of course, they're doing it in a stealth way by proposing this payroll tax holiday.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Ordinary people, voters, they probably like the idea that, oh, well, I'll have to pay less in payroll tax. That sounds like a pretty good idea. I like that. But they don't realize what that really means. And they could get the same benefit by another means, by stimulus, rather than a payroll tax holiday. You can get the same benefit. You can even get more benefit because a payroll tax holiday gives everybody the holiday. So rich people are people earning more higher incomes up to what is it, $108,000?
Right.
Will get a much bigger benefit than say a family earning $20,000 to $30,000. They'll get a very small benefit. But if you have a plan where those most in need, stimulus for those most in need, then you will get the most bang for the buck. If you give tax benefits to rich people, they're going to spend what they're going to spend. That tax break won't make them spend any more. But if you give real stimulus, not this hocus pocus that I'm afraid is going to pass, real stimulus to people who need the money, they're going to spend it right away because they have to spend it to pay their bills, pay their mortgage, buy food, et cetera, and so on. That would really be stimulus, but what's being proposed really isn't stimulus, in my opinion.
Well, also, you know, all of it is in the context that we're somehow being overtaxed in the United States. I mean, put aside for a moment the taxes that are really objectionable, like to support this incredible military establishment that we have. The taxes that people pay in the United States are the lowest rate in the Western world. I mean, there's no overtaxing that's going on here. But the way that this is going to be sold, or I think the insidious message that's going to be out there is to say, well, Social Security is going broke anyway, so why should you be paying taxes for it? And I think there will be probably a number of young people who will, that'll make sense to them.
Oh, it really does. Jim, hold that thought. Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Sure.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass. And I am a vegan. No, I am not an alien from planet Vega. I simply choose to eat plant-based foods. Join me on Ask a Vegan every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll be talking about everything from soup to nuts. Plant-based foods are the healthiest foods to eat, as well as being the most economical, the most compassionate, and the least destructive. If you want to know more about the healthy, planet-friendly, plant-based diet, call in with your questions. Or call in and share your favorite vegan recipes. Tune in on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Meir Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Back on with Jim Russell. We're talking about the retirement crisis, Social Security, Obama's new proposal that very possibly may come up for, may be introduced either probably in one house. Usually bills don't get introduced in both houses at the same time. I don't think that maybe they never get introduced in both houses at the same time, but I suspect it will be introduced first in the Senate. We'll see. And that may be on Monday, and there may even be a vote on Monday. Jim, you made what I think is an awfully important point, that because I can remember years back thinking, maybe 10, 15 years before I retired in 1999 at age 65, that maybe I'd get Social Security, but people a lot younger than I was, I wasn't so sure that they had Social Security to look forward to. So the idea that of young people today, many years to go before they retire, that they can pay in less to a system that may never give them a benefit, that may sound like a pretty good idea to them. But unfortunately, that is bad, because we need an awful lot of public opposition to this.
Oh, absolutely. And it, you know, as this story is unfolding, I'm researching a book on this, which I call The Perfect Swindle, How 401ks Undermine Retirement Security and What We Can Do. All of these things sort of fall into a pattern. So if you go back to the early 1980s in the Cato Institute, they published an article called A Guerrilla Strategy to Undermine Social Security Support. And they actually quote Lenin at the beginning of it, if you can believe this. Okay, and they argue that, well, we have to convince people that it's a bad deal. So we tell them that it's financially, it's a Ponzi scheme, that it's not going to work, that it won't be around. And they're very successful at this. So you have all sorts of people who have heard this so much that Social Security is in trouble financially that they really believe that it won't be there for them. So, you know, it's very easy to, you know, this idea that, oh, okay, well, we'll give you a 2% reduction in the taxes. You know, that's 2% out of 6.2, so it's really much more than that. And so that does sound like a good deal. The other thing that they've said consistently, which I suspect that the great majority of people believe, is that the rate of return on Social Security is much lower than you can get on a 401k or investing. Bush actually said that in Decision Points, his autobiography that just came out a month ago. I quickly looked up what he said about Social Security there, and he said that there too. Well, I took a look at my situation. I'm 66. Okay, I'm right at the age for retirement. So I could compare what the rate of return on what I've contributed to Social Security with the rate of return of what I've contributed to my, I have a 401k-like plan at work. And guess what? Social Security's rate was higher, not lower. In spite of that being said all over the place and widely believed by people. So you set up this whole atmosphere in which people just believe that Social Security is going broke, that it doesn't pay good, and then, of course, you can then start pulling away the various parts of it, if that's what your intention is to do.
Jim, I like to think about and say once in a while, talking about what I'll call the big lie. And the big lie, there are lots of big lies. Mm-hmm. There's a big lie about why we need to go to war, about a war on terror, about weapons of mass destruction, on and on and on. And another big lie that Social Security is in trouble and 401ks do much, much better than Social Security. On and on and on and on. You know, the marketplace works best. Government doesn't know what they're doing. We need to get government out of our lives. The market knows best. The market does best. Well, tell that to somebody who went to the who had their savings in 401ks or whatever, and maybe they got in late and they got hit with the dot-com bust back in 2000. And maybe another crop that got in late, and they had their savings in the bust that happened at the beginning at the end of 2007. Well, you can you make this point in your article. You can spend years accumulating savings, and in a year or two, see them either all wiped out or greatly eroded. What took years to accumulate can be just decimated in a short period of time. And that's the risk of 401ks.
Well, it's, I think, deeper than that. Of course, there's all of the volatility that's there. What the market giveth, the market king taketh away, you know, overnight. And certainly if you're just getting ready to retire and suddenly it drops by 25%, which was the average drop in 401ks, that means you're going to have to work longer to make it up. But I think the more important point is, even before the 2008 crash, people still weren't accumulating enough in those accounts. And you know, as a kind of very rough estimate, I would say they were accumulating, you know, maybe half what they would have had if it had been, you know, a comparable amount of money invested in a traditional pension. The reason why that's so important is because you have people who are attached to the 401k industry, the financial services industry, who just say, well, be patient. You know, the market will come back and then you'll be okay, which is not at all true. I mean, unless something incredibly unforeseen happens and the market takes off like a rocket. But nobody is predicting that is going to happen.
Well, those who got caught in the 1929 crash, the market lost 89%, and it took 25 years for the market to recoup the entire loss. 25 years.
52 or so. When it...
Oh, well, I mean, that was the worst, but it can happen again. There are terrible excesses that have been built up over many, many years. And there are people who think that the piper will be paid. There's an awful lot of shenanigans going on that have made the market go up a lot more so over the past nearly 2 years now. I guess it'll be 2 years next March. So call it a year and a half. An awful lot of shenanigans that have manipulated the market higher, not based on fundamentals. And at some point, the music will stop, and there may be a terrible price to pay. I fear, and I don't know, but making predictions is a pretty hazardous business. But I fear that there could be something worse than what happened in 2008, But when it'll happen, who knows? How long it'll take to play out, who knows? But anybody banking on a retirement with savings, with nothing else to back them up, they could be hurt very badly if they're getting very close to that retirement age. And Jim, in your article, you make other important points, like people with 401ks, IRAs, whatever. There are ways that they can tap those savings for medical expenses, for college tuition, and so on and so forth, maybe to make a home down payment. Well, you tap your retirement savings, and, you know, again, what you saved over a period of time, and you take out a chunk of it, it's going to take a long time to recoup what you took out. Retirement savings should be for retirement. It shouldn't be to buy a house or to pay bills or for any other purpose. It should be for when you retire, and then you know it's there for you, and you don't monkey with it along the way.
Absolutely. That's also the superiority of traditional pensions, is they're dedicated to one thing, which is to finance retirement. When you have 401ks, not only is it something that you can pull money out of along the way, but also with 401ks, the idea is that you build up individual wealth, and then that wealth you use to finance your retirement, so that if you die, you can leave that wealth to your heirs, which, of course, is a wonderful thing for the people who receive it, but it totally undermines the whole notion of social insurance, which is that when you have social insurance, everybody paying into a pension fund, if somebody lives a long time, much more than average, they know that they'll always have an income till they die. Somebody who dies right after they become eligible for the pension, where does that money go? It goes to support the people who are still in the system. So in a lot of ways, the short-lived subsidize the long-lived, which is what gives, you know, higher benefits, or one of the reasons why people have higher benefits in pension funds than they do in this approach of trying to build up private accounts, which just does not work. I mean, you build up something, but it really, you're basically, here's the other point here, is that you're supporting both your retirement and the financial services industry in these things instead of just your retirement.
Oh, yeah, you made that point. They take their pound of flesh out of investments, and you can end up...
Minimally, 20% of whatever you build up will go, minimally.
That
and
really
for a lot
is shocking.
Of people, up to 40% or so.
I mean, most people would never imagine it, Jim, because they all, if you get into a mutual fund or something the equivalent of that, there is a there is an annual fee, and they might have some expenses you pay, but the percentage is very low, which is deceptive again, because over the years it just adds up and adds up and adds up, and they can take 20% of your investment away. That really is shocking.
What a lot of people don't realize is that when you get into these plans, they inexorably collect commissions and fees off of them. Even if you do absolutely nothing, if you just let the money sit there, they're still raking off fees, you know, maintenance fees and so forth. They've got so many fees, and some of them are visible, a lot of them are not visible. I mean, it's really kind of an iceberg. What you see is, you know, just the tip of it.
Oh, absolutely. Again, the system is set up, or to just put it plainly, the system is rigged to benefit the people who run it. And most ordinary people, middle, lower-income people, mainly middle because they're the ones that can save more certainly than the lower-income people, they're the ones who are just out there not realizing that whatever they may be getting, if they're lucky to get it, they're also being taken advantage of. And unfortunately, government is very much a partner with industry on this, the industry being the financial industry, which, in my opinion, is the most powerful in the country, especially the big Wall Street banks that basically run things if they control the money.
Anybody? You know what was a real eye-opener for me in doing this because I knew that with the 401ks, it represented just a whole new flow of money into the financial services industry, is that the financial services industry in the United States has about 4.5% of the labor force work within it, but it has a full 27% of the profits. It's an extraordinary disproportion, an extraordinary distortion of our economy. Okay, so that you're absolutely right. The financial, you know, the financial industry is the core of power in this country.
Well, there's no. All you have to do is look at who the economic advisors are for both Republicans and Democrats, and they either come from Wall Street or in some way they're related to Wall Street. Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, formerly head of the New York Fed. The New York Fed, there are 12 Federal Reserve districts, and the New York Fed is called the Mother Fed because they all own a piece of the so-called Federal Reserve that isn't federal and it doesn't have reserves, as Ron Paul likes to say. It is controlled by the big banks in the 12 districts, but the New York Fed owns the majority share. Well, that's not surprising because you've got Wall Street. So Wall Street basically controls the nation's money, and as the Rothschilds said back in the 19th century, Jim, you know, give me control of the money, and I don't care what the government does or what laws they make. You control the money. It's the air in our lungs. It's the blood in our veins. That's the power of the country controlling the money, and they've got it, and they basically run things. And you've got all the economic people coming from the big financial firms, and they make economic policy, and they sure haven't done a very good job, Jim, except for themselves. 2008, Wall Street had greater profits than any year in their history. When Main Street was going through what I think was the early stages of a depression.
If I can sort of change course a little bit from all of this depressing reality that we're dealing with here, to actually talk about a very important victory that a lot of people don't know against the financial services industry. I live in Connecticut, and for the last 3 years, I've been key part of an organization called the Connecticut Committee for Equity in Retirement, which is made up of state employees in Connecticut who are in a 401k type plan, when we simultaneously had a state pension plan that a lot of people were kind of deceived out of that plan. We fought for 3 years to get the right to move back into the traditional pension plan when everyone said that that's not possible, and we actually won it about a month and a half ago through a union grievance. So now something like 12,500 state employees will be given the option to return to a traditional pension plan, something that the financial services industry is not very happy about. Because the precedent is huge, because we have a similar situation to 49 other states where there are employees trapped in these 401k-type plans when there are much better pension plans, and indeed the pension plans that the right-wingers are attacking all the time. But anybody who looks at them correctly will know that they're not in financial problems.
That really is a marvelous story, and I knew that happened because I heard you discuss it on another program, and you mentioned it to me in an email, and that really is marvelous. It tells me, Jim, and again, this is something I like to say often, and include at least very briefly in some of the articles I write, that it's amazing what people can accomplish if they decide they want to do it and they go at it. But if you just say, oh, God, it's me against the government, what can I do against them, even when you don't like something? Well, you can do plenty if you try, and that is a terrific example. If you did it in Connecticut, why can't the other 49 states do it?
Well, of course they can. And before we did that, school teachers did the same thing in West Virginia when they had been forced into a 401k in 1990, and a lot of them had not accumulated more than $25,000, you know, some 16 years later or so. They worked through their union, and they convinced the legislature that this was not a good idea to retire a bunch of teachers into poverty, where they would then have to collect, you know, welfare payments from the state government. It was much better to let them have, you know, a regular type retirement plan, a pension plan. And so they were given the option, and something like 78% of them chose to switch from their 401k back to a traditional pension. So what's great about these stories is that everything is going the other direction. You know, it's like, you know, Bush wants to end part of Social Security, push more people into 401ks. The right wing is screaming all over the place to end state pension plans. And yet we have some small victories of people going exactly in the opposite direction. Because underneath all of the lies and all the falsities that are being spread is the reality that anybody looking at it, you know, in some correct way will see that it's much better deal for states to have pension plans than to be just, you know, shoveling money into the financial services industry.
Boy, is it ever. And a sort of analog to what you just described, Jim, is a topic that I discuss on this program, especially with one guest. Did it yesterday with my guest. The idea of states on their own setting up their own state-owned bank, competing with the Federal Reserve. And yet there's only one state that's done it, and that's North Dakota. They've had it for about 100 years. It's been extremely successful. North Dakota, of all the states, is the only one showing a surplus. They have prosperity, where the other states are having a terrible time. In my own state of Illinois, per capita, I think we may have the worst problem in the country. California is the biggest state, so in total dollars, they have the biggest problem. But Illinois is certainly not a small state, and we have an immense problem, just an enormous deficit and all kinds of problems. So it's slashing all over the place, whether it's layoffs or cutting benefits or whatever, firing teachers. I mean, it's terrible stuff going on, but none of this is happening in North Dakota because North Dakota has its own bank. They're not beholden to the Federal Reserve, and it works. They create money. They can't print it the way the Federal Reserve does, but they create it their own way by the magic of fractional reserve banking that I can explain very rudimentarily, but it really seems like black magic, where you literally create money out of thin air. And it's not money, it's credit. What you have in your wallet or in loose change, well, that's not really money. That's just a small stuff that doesn't amount to anything. It's that credit that's created by computer strokes. That's the real money in the country, and that's done. And North Dakota does it like any other bank, and it's a wonderful system. And other states know about it, but why haven't they adopted it? They could bail themselves out of their financial crisis, Jim, if they only did what North Dakota has done, because they know it works, and yet they don't do it.
Well, we have a variation on that idea for retirement. What you're supposed to do with 401ks when you get ready to retire, you can take them as a lump sum, or you can buy what's called an annuity, which is you give your money to a life insurance company, which then promises you to pay you a certain amount for the rest of your life. The problem with the private commercial annuities is that the life insurance companies take their pound of flesh out of them, so they're very expensive and not a very good deal. The states, with their public pension funds, could start selling annuities and compete with the commercial market, and they could afford to give people much better annuities. Social Security could do the same. It would be basically a nationalization of the annuity business. It would benefit Social Security financing. It would benefit the people who would buy the annuities from it. So there are very creative solutions to a lot of these financial problems, but they're solutions that the private sector is loath to see happen, which is to have an aggressive public sector that actually looks after people's interests.
And the truth is that so often the public method works a lot better than the private method, because the public method doesn't take its pound of flesh, especially the big one that the private sector takes. And I mean, it's amazing. Instead of getting government out of our lives, Jim, we need to get it more into our lives, doing the right
kind of government
for all of us. Well, I just hope people get riled up enough at what is currently going on right now, and it'll be center stage, I'm guessing, on Monday. There is a scheduled vote on Monday. Whether it'll happen, we'll see. But center stage on Monday, and we heard all the Democrat bluster, what they don't like. Watch what they in fact do. That's the key. And I'm afraid they're going to betray us again. I wish I wasn't quite as pessimistic as I am, Jim. But I want to be proved wrong. I honest to God want to be proved wrong. But I really worry. And I'm old enough to look back when it wasn't this way. It was much better. It was much different. It wasn't perfect. But it was much different than what exists today, including good jobs for people that are in China now. And they're not as good there as they were here. That's what I grew up in when I got my MBA in 1960, 50 years ago this past, I got it in February. My class officially graduated in May of 1960. It's a different world, Jim. We need the kind of world you're talking about, and people need to understand the problems to realize what we have to do to fix them, and just push government to do it, because they won't do it, Jim, unless we push them.
Right.
Jim, many, many thanks. That music means the hour is over. It always goes too fast. It's a big, big topic, Jim. I hope we can go back and talk about this again.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the program. It's a wonderful service that you do.
Jim, it was a great honor for me to have you on. And you can be sure I'm not going to let go of this topic. I know you won't either. If you can remember, alert me when your book comes out, because I absolutely want to get you back to talk about that. Have you got a publishing date, any idea?
No, I'm still working on the book, so it'll be a while.
If you remember, let me know, because that is a book I want to discuss on this program. Jim, many,
great.
Many thanks. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.
And join us
Bye-bye.
Next week, Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern, weekends, 1 p.m. Make it a regular habit.